This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of the Naz and Wally Sports Hour, heard Sunday mornings at 9 on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
The world doesn't need another sports show. It needs an awesome sports show. You're listening to the Naz and Wally Sports Hour on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Good morning, Naz. Good morning, Wally. The boys are back. Let's talk sports.
Good morning and welcome to the Naz and Wally Sports Hour. I'm your host, Walter Rigabon. Joining me as usual, my co-host, Naz Marchese. Good morning, Naz. How are you?
Good, Wally. How are you?
I'm doing great. I hope you're feeling better.
Much better. Good. Much better.
Good stuff. Listen, Naz, I understand you've been moonlighting on me, doing an appearance on some rival network. Tell me all about that.
Oh, it was just the fan.
Yeah.
You know, they had Matthew's show on yesterday from 9 to 12, right?
Yeah.
And they asked the question, if Canada and Italy would play each other, who would we go for?
Yeah.
And they asked me, and I told them I'd go with Canada 100%.
Yeah, that's a topic we'll talk today. In case our listeners didn't know, Naz's son Matt is a personality down at the Fan, and we've had him on the show here a few times. A young, exciting, young sports journalist, sports broadcaster, Matt Marchese. He's got a extremely bright future in the business, and Naz, I'm sure that must have meant all the world to you to be able to appear on your son's show. Fantastic, good stuff, and it's a topic we're going to talk about today, because Canada, what an incredible 2 weeks for the Canadian men's national football / soccer team. Who would have thunk it? In this latest round, they won all three games, two of them in Central America, where they haven't done all that well before, and an incredible game against the United States last Sunday at Tim Hortons Field in Hamilton. We are all getting extremely excited about the men's national soccer team, and who better to talk about it after the first break than Canadian Soccer Hall of Famers, and have been capped, proudly wore the red and white back in the late 70s and early 80s, Carmen and Marcantonio and Roberto Iarrucci. So we're going to get an opportunity to celebrate what's going on in Canadian men's national soccer as we make our way towards the World Cup this fall. And it looks pretty good that Canada's going to have a team there. And I know, Naz, you were on the air yesterday talking about what happens if Canada meets Italy and which way we line up with that game. And Naz, I know you said you'll be proudly wearing the red and white. A lot of times it's the black and white, but we all know what that means. We'll be singing "Oh Canada" at the beginning of the game. It's a wonderful celebration when they start these World Cup games. Each of the teams lines up and they bellow out their own national anthems. I know, Naz, you're going to be belting out "O Canada," as will I. I mean, obviously, we are passionate Azzurri fans, but in a matchup against Canada, I'm right there with you, Naz.
Yeah, for sure.
Certainly. So we'll get a chance to talk about that later on in the hour. The Olympics are going on in Beijing, started this week. We're going to have the privilege of speaking with Richard Pound, the first president of the World Anti-Doping Agency, and Canada's, I believe he's the world's longest serving member of the IOC. He's certainly Mr. Olympics in Canada, and who better to talk about the Olympics than Richard Pound. Beijing this year is not without its controversy. Politics rears its ugly head in all facets of human endeavor these days, and it's certainly rearing its head in the Beijing Olympics. Quite a bit going on over there, quite a bit of criticism of the regime over there and what's going on in that country and how the Olympic movement should react to it. So we'll certainly have that opportunity. Leafs, Naz, I hope we get a chance perhaps at the end of the show to get them in, but we got a few minutes before to go to break. They had a nice little run before going into the All-Star break there, Naz. Bring us up to speed.
For both the Leafs and the Raptors, they've been very impressive, both teams.
What'd you see? I mean, the first one against the Devils was kind of a tough one. Had to come back in that one, but they laid it to them the following evening in New Jersey. What do you see with this
Austin
team?
Austin Matthews has been terrific, and as Mitch Marner, they've been two great players every game. They're dominating out on the ice, and it looks good.
Yeah, Austin Matthews wouldn't say he's phenomenal. He's absolutely phenomenal player. I wouldn't say he's taken his game to another level, but he's certainly cemented his place in the conversation as one of the top players in the NHL. Not so sure I can go as far as saying the top player in the NHL, but he's certainly in the conversation. No question about it. I mean, he's going, he's such a force out there. So much skill. He can play both ends of the ice. And as you said, Naz, they had missed Marner for quite a bit of time. Marner, perhaps for the first time in his career, a little bit of a victim of a little bit of criticism earlier on in the season. But since he's come back, no criticism in his game at this point, Naz.
No question. And he scored in 7 straight games, Wally, so he's been pretty good. And the defense is holding on just barely, though. I think they need some help back there, though.
Yeah, that would be the concerning part of this Leaf team is the rear end. But they are, you look at some of their stats. They're fourth in goals for, sixth in goals against. That's not too shabby. I mean, we tend to microanalyze everything the Leafs do, and we watch the games, we see the glaring mistakes on the rear end, and Muzzin. He's injured, but he hasn't been having the greatest season by his standards, and some of the young guys are, I think Sandin has upped his game. Then some of the other guys get criticized, Hole and Dermott and Liljegren, and as Leaf fans, we tend to over analyze and over criticize their mistakes. But Leafs fans are Leafs fans. Right? That's what we do. But we're on a pace for 119 points. We're basically tied. I mean, if you look at we're 8 points back of Tampa right now, but that's a misleading stat. We're 5 points back of Florida, but that's a misleading stat because we've got 5 games in hand on Tampa and
not to reverse. Well,
no, sorry, 8 games in hand on Tampa and 5 games in hand. I hope I've got the math right on Florida. So we're basically, if you go by points percentage, the Leafs are basically tied for first place in their division. And Boston, with these couple of victories that we just got, we got a little bit of space on Boston. I think they're 5 points behind us, and we have 1 game in hand. So if the Leafs can keep that little march going, it could be interesting. Naz,
they have a bunch of home games left. Well, there's the canceled games. They're almost all at home. So they're going to be at home a lot in the next couple of months. So I can see it being very productive. And the Leafs could finish first, and Boston could finish eighth, and they could play in a series anyway.
Well, I think the reality, the way this season is shaping up, the 8 teams that are going to make the playoffs in the East are basically almost all settled at this point. And you're looking at a dose of the Florida teams, Tampa and Florida. Carolina's playing extremely well. The Penguins got their mojo back. There's Washington in the mix. The Rangers are a drastically improved team. There's no weak links in this. There's no weak links in this Eastern Conference. It doesn't matter who and Boston, of course, who are always tough. You got to go into the playoffs against Bergeron, and maybe they don't have Chara back there anymore, but you got Bergeron and Marchand and Pasternak. They've certainly caused the Leafs some damage over the past But the reality is there are no, there's not going to be any easy nights in the playoffs this year in
for
the
anything,
East.
Really. For anything.
They are all good teams, and any one of those teams in the East could potentially go to the Stanley Cup. I wouldn't be surprised by any of them. They are all ultra competitive, it's going to be a tough grind for the Leafs. It really doesn't matter. Finishing first is always strive for that, but it doesn't matter where you finish in the East this year. You are going to have a tough matchup in the first round of the playoffs. There's no question about it, Ness.
Yeah, Pittsburgh's goaltending is very good.
Tristan Jarry's been playing out the lights. And, you know, maybe if we get a minute or two at the end of the show, maybe we'll talk about Jack Campbell and Peter Mrazek. On that note, it's time for our break. When we come back from break, we'll have Canadian Soccer Hall of Famers Carmen and Marc Antonio and Roberto Iarrucci. Look forward to it.
It was a rainy day when Pizzaville asked, do you want to meet the hot Hawaiian of your dreams? This hot Hawaiian is slathered in bacon, red onion, spicy sausage, pineapple, and hot banana peppers. A large thin crust is just $16.99. One bite and you'll say, "Lew, wow!" You might even get a lay on the beach. Call Pizzaville at #3636 on your cell phone.
This is Daryl Sittler for Alta Infinity in Vaughan. I've worked with some great teams over the years, and the staff at Alta ranks among the very best. Expert sales, superior service, and the largest selection of Infinity cars and SUVs in Canada, and the most competitive pricing anywhere. It's no wonder that Alta has been an all-star performer for well over a decade. Visit AltaInfinityWoodbridge.com, or better yet, drop by the No. 7 Auto Mall at the corner of Martin Grove and Highway 7. Experience the difference that makes Alta Infinity the captain's choice.
We all value our sporting heroes. But what price would you put on one in mint condition? If you ask us, you'll get an honest answer. Mint Inc. Trading Cards and Sports Merchandise is looking to buy your vintage collection of hockey, basketball, baseball, football, and soccer heroes. Come and see us in person at our new Toronto Mint Inc. Gallery, now open at 198 Davenport, east of Avenue Road, or visit our store online at mintink.ca. Show us what you got, and we'll show you the money. Think Mint Inc.
They're not here to be nice. They're here to be right. The boys are back. The Naz and Wally Sports Hour on Zoomer Radio.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Naz and Wally Sports Hour. We are live on the new AM 740 in Toronto. We're also on FM 96.7, and we stream on the internet all over the world, www.zoomerradio.ca. We're pleased to welcome back to the Naz and Wally Sports Hour Canadian Soccer Hall of Famers Carmen and Marc Antonio and Roberto Iarrucci. Good morning, gentlemen. Carmine, you first. How are you this morning, Carmine?
Good morning to you, Walter, Naz, and Roberto, that I haven't seen in the longest time. But, I'm down still in the Sunshine State in Miami, enjoying the beautiful view of the Atlantic Ocean.
Well, good. God bless you, Carmine. Roberto, we have you this morning. How are you today, Bob?
Well, I'm also very good, Walter and Naz. Good morning to you, and I say good morning from the frozen tundra of Mississauga.
Yes.
I'm glad Carmen is having such a good time. Yeah, I hope that he's not putting too much syrup on his waffles.
Anyways, I know you guys are really good friends and have been friends since you played minor soccer in the Toronto area in the early 1970s with a club that I'm very familiar with. You guys are proud alumni of the Westwood Soccer Club, which was the dominating youth soccer club in Ontario in the early 1970s. You guys both graduated to the North American Soccer League, won championships in the North American Soccer League, played with some of the best players in the history of the sport on the same teams and against them. Of course, I'm talking about players like the names of Pelé, Cruyff, Quinalla, Beckenbauer. You guys have seen the best of soccer, the best in historical terms. You've seen the best of Canadian soccer. You are the best of Canadian soccer. You were both capped You both proudly wore the red and white for our country. You're both proud Canadians. You're both Canadian Soccer Hall of Famers. Bob, I'm going to go to you first time around on this one, and then to you, Carmine. Bob, we are on the threshold of making history in Canada. We, based on the last three performances, we are literally just 1 point away from qualifying for the World Cup. I can't say that it's unexpected, but I didn't see it playing out this way. I didn't see Canada. I wouldn't say they're dominating the group, but they are in first place in the group. They are 4 points clear of the arch nemesis, the United States and Mexico. I believe we're 8 points clear of Panama and 9 of Costa Rica. We are this a hair close to making it. How does this make you feel, Bob?
Well, I think it's a fantastic moment in sport, period. Yes, for soccer in this country and how we've suffered over the generations. Carmen and I were part of the 1982 Barcelona qualification series, so we know how it felt not to qualify by one goal. So I will say this. I want to congratulate Jason DeVos, John Herdman for herding this team together, if I may use that pun. They've done a tremendous job. They're deep at all positions, and they've been able to overcome a whole bunch of obstacles, which CONCACAF probably has more than any other region in the world. And to lead the group of eight by 4 points with three games to go is just a magnificent achievement. Never mind the official note that we haven't qualified yet. We've qualified and then some. There's no way that Canada will not be able to qualify officially after we play Costa Rica, and I just can't say enough. I'll leave some of the more superlatives to my good friend Carmen to add to that. I really am so proud, and in many ways, I'm overwhelmed by it.
10 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, Robbie hit it right on the nail. I mean, this is a team that has been just amazing. I mean, there's no other word. And the fact is, a lot of credit goes to, as Robbie says, to Jason DeVos, first of all, because he's now, let's say, on the technical side, head of Football Canada, I'd like to call it, by the real name, football, as you know, Walter. And Herdman and his staff. I mean, Mauro Biello's assistant and all the coaching staff have done an amazing job. First of all, assembling some quality young players that a lot of them are playing in Europe. I think that makes a big difference that these boys have been playing now a few years, some of them, and of course the Major Soccer League, the others. So at the top level, and in Europe, a heavy game means something. So they've got the experience of what it means to become a team, a unit, and that's what they've become. They fight for each other, they love to play for each other, and if I look at the last window, the three games, it's amazing that John Herdman used to basically every game he changed at least 4 or 5 last game from the U.S. to El Salvador. There were 7 changes from the starting lineup. And so that tells you that doesn't matter who shows up for that game, they're going to, just sweat, blood and tears and make sure that they're going to get the results. And, they're not number one by fluke, as Bobby said. They don't concede much, Walker. They won the last three games 2-0, and they haven't conceded a goal. They, I think, only conceded like 4 or 5. They're number one in goal scoring, and they're number one in every statistic, and number one team in CONCACAF. So it's not official. Let's not forget, because with that 1 point, and we gotta go to Costa Rica, we gotta go still to Panama. And the last game, I think, it's at home against Jamaica, if I remember well. So, I mean, like Bobby said, we're that's almost 2 feet in the World Cup, and hopefully this team is going to remain number one, and they'll be first in CONCACAF.
And Naz, I want to turn it over to you.
John Herdman is a guy that we need to talk about. I remember a couple of years ago when he was hired, we weren't too happy with the hiring, none of us. And look what he's done. He's built a women's team, and now he's built a men's team. How important is he to the whole mix?
Well, another one who was skeptical. I'll be very honest, because, notwithstanding the good work that John did with the women's team, he really didn't have a resume handling a men's program. And so I was a little leery. I could imagine that Jason had hundreds of applicants on his desk that he could have gone through with a stronger resume behind him than John. But what John does have, and probably is the most important prerequisite of coaching today, and he's taken a page out of the great Sir Alex Ferguson, is the ability to man-manage. And today, guys, when I hear people talking about 4-4-2 and 4-3-3, then I know that they don't know very much about soccer. Because the game of soccer are the ability to fuse with each other, the ability to want the other player to do well, even if he plays in your position, the ability to be there at all costs, fight for each other, like Carmen said, and to dedicate yourself to the final cause. That's very hard to do, because in the way are people's egos. They all want to play. They all want to be showcased. And if they feel they've been done wrong, they're going to talk behind people's back. It's human nature. And what John has done is he's eliminated all that. And if nothing else, that's the most important part of coaching, in my opinion, and not only soccer, and any type of high-performance program of athletics.
Kamir, before I go to you, I just want to pick up on Bob's comment, which was, when they hired John Herdman, I've got to be honest with you, I was critical of it at the time, with regret now. It's easy being a Monday morning quarterback. Now, I had the same concerns Bob had, and they had seemed to have changed their game completely under the guy that they got rid of. I can't remember his name. He was doing well too.
Well, they were playing well, and then we were
criticizing Herdman. But I wouldn't say you apologize, but I was wrong. And I'm more than happy to admit that John Herdman has been wonderful for this particular team. It's almost he's the right man at the right time for the right group of players. You can obviously see that these, as you said, Bob, this team has bonded together. They are having fun. They don't seem to have the pressure of the world on their shoulders. They go out there and they're having fun. I find the most incredible part when they're playing and they show these pictures of Alphonso Davies, who's injured and wasn't able to play in the last three games. They got him on camera, on social media, and he's having the time of his life watching his teammates playing, and he's so excited, and he smiles, and he jumps up and down when his teammates and it's a wonderful thing to see when a team comes together at the right time with the right coach, and they may not be the most I'm not even sure they're the most talented team in this group, but they are the best team in the classical sense of the term. Kadmina, your thoughts?
Yeah, the best team is what makes it really resounding, because, like you say, maybe player per player, but even that I would argue, because with player per player, we have some amazing young players, and, some of the two youngest players that's worth a lot of money in the world soccer, football, it's Davis by Munich. He's probably one of the, most valuable players as far as value is concerned. And David now, apparently, everybody wants him. He plays for Lille, and his worth is at least 50 million euros, if not more. And I know there's the biggest clubs in Europe are up to him. He's going to move. He's going to leave Lille, and, the stock is in Milan wants him, Liverpool wants him, all the big clubs, Barcelona wants him. So, and Acheson at 39 is an amazing player. He's been playing in Turkey. And what about other good, the good there. I can't even say his name. The left fullback. I mean, these are players that somehow we didn't know about them, other than Alfonso and David, the Laren. I mean, you know, these are great players. And you got to give kudos to John Herdman. I told Bobby after the first game, I mean, I remember we had that conversation against Honduras when we tied, and Bobby wasn't sure about Herdman. I said, Bobby, listen, we got to give this man a chance. Before we you know, criticize anyone, I think it's only the first game. Let's give him a chance and let's see what he's able to do. Because he was amazing with the women's program. I mean, he built that program, and Jason DeVos is picking him. Knew something that nobody else knew in Canada, that this guy is a psychologist, he's a philosopher, he's a sociologist, whatever, you know, he's a great public relation. He could communicate with media, he communicates with his players. He's an amazing coach, because he's got the team playing also. I mean, we play good football, and we're not number one, I don't think, by fluke. Okay, we're number one because this team deserves to be number one in CONCACAF.
Yes.
And I'm going to end it with that, because they're going to, like, once they qualify, and you know, like Bobby said, we are there. We should be there in Qatar based on what we've done. They're going to also mesmerize the world. I think this team will, in Qatar, will do really well, and the big boys better watch out, because I believe in this team. They made me a believer.
Nas,
where are they going to end up with FIFA rankings after this, guys? And how important is it that they move up the ladder in FIFA rankings?
Well, I think that whole FIFA ranking thing, you know, I mean, when the United States can be ranked number 11 and Mexico number 14, a few people in Zurich need their heads examined. If those two teams are ranked 11 and 14, where should Canada be? 7? I mean, well, honestly.
They'd be tied with Italy if they were 7.
Oh, my God. Like, you know, okay, so there's an exaggeration on both sides.
Yeah.
How did the United States get to be 11th ranked? Who did they play?
Well, I've always...
Bob, did they beat Holland? Did they beat Germany? Yeah. Who did they play? I don't know.
Didn't play anybody. I don't know. I have no idea how FIFA ranks teams. I mean, whatever their algorithm is, it probably needs to be sent back to a mathematician. I never understood how Belgium was the top team in the world for 2 or 3 years, ranked number one. I mean, good players, golden generation, as they call it. But what did they ever win? Never won anything. So I didn't understand how Belgium was number one. In Canada, I think, help me out, Kadminet, I think we're up into 33.
We're number 40 right now. I'm sure that they're 40. They're going to reshuffle the deck. They'll end up being in the low 30s.
I can't see how you can keep this team out of the top 30 at this particular moment in time.
Walter, yeah. Sorry. I mean, let's get our feedback on the ground too. I mean, listen, we were ranked number 60 plus not long ago, okay? And even though not perfect, the FIFA ranking is based on international games of value. That, you know, there's no, most of the games are international. We have some meaning, okay? And so based on victories and all that, I mean, their ranking obviously is not perfect, but it gives you a picture of where nations are based on their results of the last 2-3 years. And Belgium has been one of the top teams, in their performance at the European level, which is, you know, top teams in Europe, let's say this. And then you got the Brazil, Argentina, that will never change. They're going to be always ranked up there, you know, the seeds are what they are. But you know, when it comes to Canada, you know, now the ranking right now, I think, reflects what Canada has done in the past and what they've done in the last 2 years. I mean, Canada, you know, we had a difficult time in the past going to Honduras and El Salvador and Mexico. And never mind. I mean, the last time we played in Honduras, I remember it was embarrassing. We lost 8-0. I was embarrassed. That was only 4 years ago. And that's when we come to ranking number 80 plus 90, wherever we were. Now, Canada is down to 40, which I think reflects what they've been doing the last 2 years under Herdman, under the program. I think it, you know, they become unbeaten like they are now in the next three games, next window in March. They could go down as far as, you know, in the low 30s. I think it reflects where Canada should be now in the world rankings. And even though yeah. they're not perfect, but it reflects what, you know, it's like tennis, you know, the seeding in tennis. You know, sometimes number one loses in the, you know, in tennis, could lose in the first round. That happens all the time. But Canada, you know, deserves the position they're at now, I think. Like Belgium may deserve being ranked number one, you know.
Carmen, we can agree to disagree. We'll have that. I'll counter that debate at another time. Unfortunately, we've got to get to Dick Pound to talk about the Olympics. So, Bob and Carmen, we're going to thank you. I talked to your good friend the other day, Bob Lenarduzzi, and we've all agreed that we're going to do a roundtable, all of us, when Canada goes back at it at the end of March. So I look forward to picking up this conversation, and as Canada heads towards the World Cup, I'm sure we'll have lots of opportunities to celebrate this great, great year in Canadian soccer. Bob Carmine, thank you so much for this morning. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Take care, guys.
Thank you, Walter. Thanks, Nats. Have a good day.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. Got Dick Pound coming up. We'll be right back.
It was a rainy day when Pizzaville declared, "We'll never be the fastest. We'll never be the cheapest. We'll never be the snazziest dressed."
What?
Yeah, my point is, we want to be the best. At Pizzaville, we want to make the best pizza. Stone-baked, the traditional Italian way.
Pizzaville, stone-baked pizza. Fiercely Canadian. Authentically Italian.
We all value our sporting heroes. But what price would you put on one in mint condition? If you ask us, you'll get an honest answer. Mint Inc., trading cards and sports merchandise, is looking to buy your vintage collection of hockey, basketball, baseball, football, and soccer heroes. Come and see us in person at our new Toronto Mint Inc. Gallery, now open at 198 Davenport, east of Avenue Road, or visit our store online at mintink.ca. Show us what you got, and we'll show you the money. Think Mint Inc.
There's an old saying, entrepreneurship doesn't build character, it reveals character. Entrepreneurs learn to trust a person by trusting people. The law firm Rigabon Carly understands this. They know all about entrepreneurs because they work for them. Every day, they've earned their trust. They know that when it comes to meeting the legal and business needs of entrepreneurs, good enough is not enough. Rigabon Carly, the intelligent choice.
Opinions expressed on the Naz and Wally Sports Hour are those of Naz and Wally and their guests.
There are two ways to argue sports with these guys, and none of them work. The boys are back, the Naz and Wally Sports Hour on Zoomer Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to the Naz and Wally Sports Hour. We are live on the new AM 740 in downtown Toronto, 96.7 FM, and streaming www.zoomerradio.ca. We're pleased to welcome back to the Naz and Wally Sports Hour the longest-serving member of the International Olympic Committee and the first president of the World Anti-Doping Agency, a gentleman who really requires no introduction, Mr. Richard Pound. Good morning, Richard. How are you this morning?
Very well indeed. Nice to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us, Richard. The Olympics are on in Beijing. There's a certain level of criticism of what's going on. We certainly don't want to dwell the entire interview with you on the criticism. The Olympic movement is something that has been part of world history and has contributed so much. So we should never lose sight of the fact of the importance of the Olympic movement and why the Olympic movement was originally founded. So we don't want to necessarily dwell on all the current negative aspects of it. We certainly do want to dwell on some of the positive aspects of the movement, Richard. Beijing, some criticism. Let's get it out of the way. You were quoted, I mean, obviously there's a lot of people around the world that think the Olympics shouldn't go on. There's polls that say Canada shouldn't be there. We get into the whole issue of politics and sports. You were quoted this week as saying this, and then there certainly wasn't much choice in these particular Olympics. There weren't a lot of bidding cities. for this particular Olympics. And you said this is not a political exercise. This is a sport exercise. Richard, what did you mean by that?
Well, it's just that people have these unrealistic expectations of what the International Olympic Committee can actually do in terms of bringing about state conduct change. And so we've said, look, we can't do that. We have no mandate, no expertise, no power. What we do try and demonstrate is that it is possible for the 206 countries in the Olympic movement to come together every 4 years, live together, train together, eat together, compete together, all peacefully. And this is something that can't be duplicated by any other organization in the world. So let's look at ways of creating an inclusive, peaceful interaction between all of these countries and the youth of these countries, and that's a contribution that nobody else can make, and it's a line of communication, in its largest sense that really does need to be open and kept open, and every 4 years for the last 100 or so, other than the two world wars, we've created this island of international peace and cooperation, and that's worth it. It may not last, but it's certainly a lot better than what the professional politicians have been able to accomplish in terms of state relationships.
Before I turn it over to Naz, I'm just going to one more question for Richard, then I'll turn it over to you. The response that a lot of the countries came up this year. There's obviously concern about human rights abuses, the what's going on with the Uyghurs and all kinds of different things in China. The response that a lot of the politicians or the political response has been what they're calling a diplomatic boycott. I guess they're withholding their diplomats from attending the games, and you're not finding the First Lady of the United States going to the games, and the politicians seem to be staying away from it. Is that an effective response, Richard, a diplomatic boycott? Does that accomplish anything?
Well, I think it can if it's concerted. I mean, if it's just a few here and there, it's not going to affect Chinese conduct. But, I mean, states know how to deal with other states. I mean, that's their business, and you can send all kinds of signals that indicate disagreement with or displeasure with or abhorrence of whatever may be going on in another state. And this is one way you can do it. You say, we're not going to stand in the way of the athletes who've been training for years and years and years. We agree with the idea that an institution like the Olympic Games really can make a contribution. So we're not We've moved away as states from calling on athletes to pay the price for whatever is going on, as happened. You may remember back in Moscow in 1980, it brought about zero conduct change on the part of the Soviet Union. So here they're saying, let the kids play, let the young people play. Will indicate our displeasure with, in this case, China, but it has certainly been a factor in other Olympic Games. And we will accept the responsibility of having to bring about conduct change in whatever the target country is.
Naz?
Richard, you were a swimmer back in the 60s, right? Was Terry Hammond's performance enhanced team drug down then, and what do you suspect they took back then?
Well, it's an interesting historical exploration here. You know, when I was in the Olympics in Rome, there were no sport rules that prohibited the use of drugs. And, there were some drugs were prohibited by law, but they tended to be the opioids and so on. In the Olympic Village in Rome, the weightlifters had been using testosterone and testosterone-based products for years and years and years, and it started to spread to the the throwing events in track and field and so on, and basically they were saying, well, what are you using? Well, and how much are you using? And what it is? And it wasn't until actually later in the games in Rome when a Danish cyclist died during one of the road races and was found to be laden with some stimulant. I forget exactly which one it was, but it was an ephedrine or something of that nature. And so the old boys on the IOC at the time, they were all old and all boys, said, oh, look, this isn't supposed to happen. You're supposed to come to the games to have fun and so on, not to die because you've been using drugs. And so the IOC formed a medical commission, had a subcommission on doping and biochemistry, and said, all right, let's find out what they're taking and make up a list of banned substances. So that you're not going to have people taking things. Of course, it's competitors being competitors. They say, "How much are you taking this stuff?" And they say, "Oh, well, 5 milligrams." So, well, I'm not trying to level the playing field. I'm trying to beat you. So I take 10. You find out I'm taking 10, and you go up to 20, and pretty soon you're getting up to the level of toxic or even lethal dosages. So. We prepared the list. The IOC prepared the first list of prohibited substances, and it came into effect in 1968, first at the Winter Games in Grenoble, and then later in Mexico. And it has evolved ever since then, and the most recent evolution is the creation of the World Anti-Doping Agency that you'd mentioned in the intro, a single set of rules that applies to all athletes, all countries, all sports, called the World Anti-Doping Code. And so that's what's in there now, and it's a much more sophisticated operation of involving testing and research and the use of intelligence and then informants and so forth. And it's actually becoming surprisingly effective. Not perfect yet, but we're way ahead of where we used to be.
Richard, I just want to follow up on that point. You were the first president of WADA. You are the most significant figure in the history of the sport in terms of trying to get doping out of sport. We've just touched upon it. You've just introduced some concepts about intelligent testing and that type of thing. We see the Russians are competing under the ROC banner as a penalty for their transgressions of a few years back. What is the state of doping in the sports world right now? Doesn't seem to have been that many eruptions lately, but I'm sure efforts are still being made to try and get around the rules. Have the doping agencies, for lack of a better term, caught up?
Well, I would say, the advantage, as in, if you're a bank robber, you know which bank you're going to rob and what day it is. And if you're the police, you sort of have to wait to find out what happened and then investigate further. So what we do now is make sure that everybody's aware of the list and what's on it. We can do a lot of advanced research, and we actually do work with the pharma industry, saying, what molecules are you working on? And one of the erythropoietin was something that allowed the blood to absorb more oxygen. So if you're a bent coach, you say, oh, more oxygen to the muscles. Doesn't matter that it was first developed to help cancer patients build up their blood supply after operations. And so we work with the pharma industry to see if we can anticipate what might be used. And we work with them to develop tests that will identify it. So it's far more proactive than it used to be, and I think that is becoming better understood as time goes on.
Naz, what's the Olympic policy on COVID-19 once somebody catches it in the Olympics? What is the wait time
after they get caught?
I think it used to be something like 21 or 14 days. I think it's down to 5 days. And now, as we learn a little bit more about it, especially with the Omicron variant of it. And so in Canada, for example, we just said, if you want to be on our Olympic team, you've got to be vaccinated. And, you know, you get a few of the anti-vaxxers scream about human rights, and you say, well, sue us. By the time you get any kind of a judgment, the games will be over, and you will have lost your chance to participate. So sometimes you have to take those kind of steps. But in, I would say, you know, in Beijing today, if you're in what they call the closed loop system, you're probably in the safest part of the world as far as COVID is concerned. So they do a lot of testing before you get into the bubble. And once you're in, it's very unlikely that you will catch it while you're in there.
Talking to Richard Pound. Richard, I promised you we'd talk about some of the positive aspects of the Olympic movement. And, you know, sometimes we tend to focus on the criticism up until the time the games start. And when the games start and some of our Canadian athletes start accomplishing incredible their accomplishments become really world class. You know, Andre DeGrasse and Damian Warner and the women's soccer team from the last Olympics being prime examples of that. I'm sure at some point we will get, as a nation, behind our athletes. They are wearing our colors. They will be playing our national anthem, and we'll all be very proud of them. I want to talk about the Olympics from a personal perspective, Dick. You competed in the 1960 Rome Olympics as a swimmer. You were a world-class swimmer. How did those Olympics change your life?
Well, it certainly broadened enormously. You know, in 1960, we were at the nadir of the Cold War, and you remember how the Soviets were, you know, pictured as sort of basically faceless villains. And when I was there, and I saw a whole bunch of Russian swimmers, you know, couldn't speak each other's language and so on, but they became people rather than symbols. And you know, 100 meters was just as long for them as it was for me. And sort of you each know what went into getting you to the Olympics and to the finals if you were fortunate. And so there's kind of a shared understanding that builds up, and I took that away from the games, and remember that as a change in my approach to international stereotypes. So it ended up being a wonderful experience, and I've stayed in sport because if there's anything I can do to give somebody of this generation an opportunity to have the same level of fun and exposure that I had, it's well worth it.
Couple more questions, Richard, then we'll let you go. But first, I'll turn it over to Naz, and then I have one wrap-up one. Go ahead, Naz.
Sure.
Naz, are you still there?
Yes.
Go ahead, Naz. Last question for you, and then I'll have one wrap-up one for Richard.
Richard, do you see Canada bidding on any future Olympics coming up?
Yeah, I do. I do. I mean, I think we have demonstrated that we can organize really great games, and you know, you can, if you give the games to Canada, you can be sure that they will take place and that they'll be well run. So, I kind of hope that we may look again at the Winter Games for 2030. I think that would be a great opportunity to do it back out in British Columbia, but it'll take us another probably 6 months or so after we get finished with Beijing to focus on that to see whether or not it's feasible. But no, I think we're on the A list of potential hosts.
Just following up on the 2030 Olympics. There's some reports out this week that Canada's considering an indigenous-led bid for the 2030 Winter Olympics. That would be a striking idea. Your thoughts, Richard?
I think, sort of on the international marketplace, if that's the right description for it, I think that would be very interesting because many countries are much more focused on indigenous peoples and the, you know, a combination of the past and present and future integration of them in the overall society. So I think that would be great. And I think it would be, in fact, there was a fair amount of indigenous involvement in the 2010 games in Vancouver and Whistler. So this would be building on a number of very successful relationships that were started at that time.
And we'll wrap it up with this one, Richard. One of the other areas of the Olympics that's received criticism is sometimes the scale of them becomes to a point that some people considered excessive. The Sochi being the prime example, $56 billion spent. What is the future of the Olympic? I'll just say it this way. What is the future of the Olympic Games and the Olympic movement?
I think it's very, frankly, very healthy. The $56 billion, I've never been certain that that's a real number as opposed to a manufactured number, but I remember when Russia was bidding for the Games. He said, look, when we were the Soviet Union, we had all of the winter facilities that we needed. But he said, they're now in the hands of our competitors. And what the vision was for Sochi was to have a winter sport center, both for tourism and for national use and also for international use. But the what they didn't have at the time in the Caucasus was the alpine and mountain side of things. So they had to build that. And as the bid committee at the time said, look, yes, Europe has all of this stuff already. They've had 100 years to develop it. We need to do it in the next 7 years. And so they established an entire alpine apparatus. I think the tourism side of it took a beating when the Russian Federation invaded the Caucasus, or not the Caucasus, the I'm sorry, blocking on this, but in the Crimean area. And so they didn't get the legacy that they probably should have. But that said, what we've done recently is changed the way in which we are awarding the games. We don't sort of just sit in Lausanne and wait to see what bids come through the transom. We said, no, wait a minute, these are our games. We should be out looking for the best hosts and discussing with potential hosts. How can we make this good for both of us and be a lot more flexible in terms of, you know, spreading some of the events around in within a territory and all that kind of stuff that will take advantage of what's there already, allow upgrading rather than starting from scratch, and making sure that that when the games are over, the host country has an enduring benefit that comes from that.
We've been talking, Richard Pound. Richard, the Olympics, some of the greatest, if not the greatest, moments in Canadian sport have occurred at the Olympics. There's so many examples of them. Nancy Greene, Damian Warner, Andrew DeGrasse, the Canadian men's hockey team in Salt Lake, the women's hockey team, the women's soccer team. The list is endless. It's always an incredible moment when we see that Canadian flag raised and we get to belt out our national anthem. It is certainly important, and I'd like to take the opportunity of thanking you because I know in Canadian history, you've been such a big part of that, and you deserve our thanks. Thanks so much, Richard.
Well, I think our athletes deserve it, so watch them. Watch them in Beijing, and cheer. It's Team Canada.
We certainly will. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Naz, we just got about 30 seconds left. Actually, I've just been told we have no time left.
No time.
There's no time. So, Naz, really quickly, last word.
Next week is Super Bowl Sunday. Let's see what happens.
We'll see what happens. To all our listeners, have a fantastic week. To our producer, Owen, I don't get a chance to thank you. Thanks for so much for keeping us on the air in these difficult circumstances. Have a great week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.